Welcome to Climate Talk Uganda. This is episode 5 and my name is Josephine Karunji. This is the accessible acronym-free podcast about all things climate change. This podcast is really a personal journey, a pressing one. After having had a number of interactions with guests on previous episodes who have spoken of the changes they have seen, the shifts they've experienced, and the local ecosystem and the health impacts, but also because the work I do now allows me to appreciate what a changing climate means for smallholder farmers and businesses in the country. So you might just be starting to take notice of the subject of climate change. You might already be deeply concerned. No matter where you are, I'd love you to join me in understanding what climate change means for all of us. I am not an expert, I'm a learner. And in this episode, I'd like us to unpack the complexity of climate change through the experiences of two men. Ole Rasmussen, who is a team leader, Green Economy and Climate at the Danish Embassy Uganda, has worked on climate change, private sector development and job creation. And Gerald Tenuer, who is a renowned journalist, filmmaker and media trainer. He has been covering climate change and environment for 22 years.
It's great to have you, gentlemen. Ole, you're looking at Gerald. 22 years is a long time. And even I have questions, Gerald. Why? How did you get into climate change and how have you been covering it for 22 years?
I think it's because of my previous background and training. My first degree was in forestry, and later on I studied environmental communication at Makerere University, which was sponsored by SIDA. I also did a diploma course in media and land governance. Probably to mention a little bit more, that my passion kept on growing from school, from practice, and then, of course, from other senior people who used to write about the environment. Particularly, the new vision was the late Sandy Akira Moti, who used to write passionately about the subject pieces. Another key person there was William Pike. He used to be so supportive in terms of encouraging us to cover the environment. And each story you cover, it impacts you in a certain way. And, of course, the passion keeps on growing and growing.
From environment to a focus on climate change, how did you get into that one? A lot of journalists I know struggle with finding that balance between the two.
There's a thin line. Of course, climate change is different from environment, but of course, technically, there's a thin line dividing the two. Climate change is more about the science, and then, of course, those elements of climate change that impact people's livelihood, the economy, of course, their way of life. And, of course, it is natural when you are covering the environment to combine even with climate change, because climate change does not act alone. It acts through water, either too much of it, and in that case you'll have flooding, or too little of it, and then you'll have a drought or a severe dry spell. So basically, when you are dealing with the environment and the climate change, you are dealing with one and the same thing. It's just simply one side of the coin, and it depends on the kind of story you are dealing with. And when William Pike used to assign you a story, it wouldn't matter whether you love climate change or not, because I distinguished myself as the reporter to step into the shoes of Ndi Akira Moti, and I came up to take on this story.
You said every story you cover, and I'm going to ask Ole about what you just said about climate change and environment, but you said every story you cover impacts you a certain way. What story about climate change have you covered that's impacted you, and in what way?
Of course, there are those disaster stories where many people have died, and I'll never forget them. One of them is the death of people on Mount Elgon, where more than 100 people perished in a landslide. This has been a point of reference in many books, in many testimonies about climate change. But there was also another story which I covered about the water-thirsty cities in Uganda. There are cities running out of water. And these include Kasese, Mbale, Gulu, the major cities in Uganda. They are all running out of water, especially in the dry season. And part of the reason is part of what I explained earlier, or I hinted on. Climate change does not act alone. You find that in the catchment, in the upper parts of the catchment, people are cutting down trees for various reasons, through expansive agriculture, through ways to be able to get energy, charcoal and firewood. So when it rains, the ecosystem is like a tube. Water runs quickly through the ecosystem and it packs people downstream, and that's why you have a lot of flooding. But when the dry season hits home, there's no water in the ecosystem. It dries up quickly. And that was also another big story which I did for the New Vision about 4 or 5 years ago.
That's a lot of stories, Gerald. It's beginning to add up, these 22 years that you mentioned. Ole, before I even ask you the questions that I had planned, I'm curious to know what you've been thinking listening to Gerald explain his work around climate change, and if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think these were amazing stories for many reasons. First of all, they are very specific. You can see a river changing course. You can see how water disappears more quickly, and people actually get into trouble. So I think this is really what we need to understand climate change. Very often we talk about it as a global problem, which it is. But we need really to listen to what people say and how they experience it. So I think that's very important to have those stories.
Gerald is bringing it home for us. Ole, where are you from originally?
I'm from Denmark.
Why is climate change of interest to you? Were you previously in this area? You said you were an economist before?
Yes, I studied political science and economics. So, and I actually didn't specialize in climate change. My story resonates more with your introduction, actually. I'm very much a learner of this. I've been working for the Danish government now for 10 years, working with smallholder farmers and to try to support in various ways smallholder farmers and agro-processors and agribusiness. And when you do that, eventually climate change will come to you, because you see that they face a lot of challenges, and these agricultural sectors face a lot of challenges, but climate change is definitely a key challenge. And it's a challenge that has some specific characteristics that makes it quite difficult. First of all, it's very long term. You won't find people waking up one day and saying, oh, now climate change is there, right? It's slow and it's consistent and it's serious, and that makes it quite special. I worked for 4 years in Burkina Faso before I came to Uganda, just at the border of the Sahara Desert, where climate is really affecting livelihood tremendously. And then coming to Uganda and seeing that here also so we face some of the same challenges.
How did you see climate change manifest back home in Denmark?
Well, you know, actually, many of the events are the same. So we see these 100-year events of rainfall, they are becoming not 100-year events, but maybe 50-year or 10-year events. They are becoming more frequent. So even I used to live in Copenhagen. In the center of Copenhagen, we had incidents that people had never seen before, that flooded basements and flooded streets and destroyed a lot of infrastructure. The very, very big difference, of course, is in Denmark, you know, people will dry their basements and you know, we'll lead the water to the sea and then we'll go on with our lives. Whereas here, I think the capacity to actually withstand some of those events is just for the majority of the population, which lives in rural areas, the capacity is just much lower.
Is there a specific incident that then triggered you to say, yeah, I'm going to focus on climate change because now I see it as an actual thing and not something I've been told about or, you know, reading about?
So I think that must have been in northern Uganda. I was in a discussion with quite a large number of actually staff in one of our agricultural projects. So staff who would go on their motorbikes on Monday to a village somewhere, stay there for the week and work with the farmers. And we had a very simple survey for them. We asked them, if you compare to 10 years ago, would you say that seasons have changed or not? And all of them raised their hands. Even though, if you look at the statistics, it's not always you can tease out these changes, but when you talk to people, you can really, they will really say that they have seen just in 10 years a remarkable change. And seasons, it may sound as something that is, you know, not super important, but for people living in northern Uganda who are used to knowing when to plant what and how to prepare and, you know, when to open the land, and it matters a lot if the rain comes as expected or not. So I think that's probably one of the events I will mention.
Why should it matter, this conversation on climate change? Why is it important to us, all of us?
So I think if we care about people, we should care about climate change. So to the farmers of northern Uganda, you know, they depend on what they have on their farm for and the income they get from it. And climate just gives them fewer opportunities to earn livelihood from their farm as they are used to. And I think so if we care about those farmers, then we should also care about climate change.
Jared, when I asked that question and he started to say, if you care about people, you said, mm-hmm. Why should we care about climate change?
In this country, when we have drought, all those episodes where we have disasters, like landslides, the economic growth of the country tends to get hit. And this is because we directly depend on nature for our survival as people, but also the economy. I remember very recently in 2016, we had a severe drought, and instead of the projected growth of the country, which was between 7% to 8%, it was cut down to about 3%. So these are very realities that we resonate with so many people and the economy, and of course the politicians know now about this very well, and I think that is why they are coming up strongly to come up with policy frameworks, legislative frameworks to be able to address climate change. But also, climate change affects the poor more than the rich. You find that the people who are more vulnerable to climate change are hit much more. You can imagine you have a small parcel of land of about 2-3 acres, and of course there's drought which has come. Yeah. It's like you put all your eggs in one basket and it's all gone. And I can see this when I look back home where I come from in Busoga. You have many people largely landless. Others have a small patch of land which they share amongst themselves. And once this happens, there's almost nothing to take home. And you find people taking 1 meal a day instead of the 3 or 4. You find early teenage pregnancies. These are very real on the ground, and I've seen them and sometimes cover them.
I'm just thinking, listening to you both, I'm just thinking about survival.
Yeah.
Especially when we speak about climate and we heavily relate it to agriculture, then you're speaking about the smallholder farmer. You're speaking, Gerald, about communities that are struggling financially, poor communities. So it's survival. It's you want me to stop cutting down trees, but this is where I'm getting, you know, charcoal that I'm selling and getting, you know, something. And then what do you want me to do about that?
No, that's exactly it. That's also why I think that, as Gerald said, you know, the poorest and the most vulnerable groups are also the people with the least capacity to adapt to these things. There, I think our response has to be systemic. We need to think about the systems that are in place to support these people. How can these systems be adapted for the future? So just maybe one example, coffee, which is the greatest agricultural export for Uganda. You know, the most high value coffee is Arabica coffee grown in the mountainous areas. We see temperature increases. Those mountainous areas will no longer be able to grow coffee when temperature increases. You know, farmers are not experiencing an immediate increase in temperature, but I think we do need to support these areas in changing just something as their tree varieties, which takes many years, but we have a collective responsibility to support them in doing that so that in 15 years we can still enjoy Arabica coffee from Uganda.
How easy is it, Gerald? Because I think awareness is one key area that you start with to start to change the narrative or to change the practices. How easy is that, Gerald, from your work as a journalist and trying to put out information around climate change and its impact and solutions?
Yeah, of course, the responses are quite many, just like my colleague is putting it. And it depends on the level of impact, the level of shock which people are exposed to, and which demands a certain level of response to be able to cope with climate change. In some cases like Bududa, people have been uprooted off the ground and they have had to be moved to other parts where they can be able to live another life.
But then they still go back?
Yes, but not everybody goes back. A few of them go back because of the attachment they have with the mountains. And of course, this goes with the level of development. People in Uganda, they are still so tied up with the land because this is where they derive a livelihood. And of course, that also matches with their culture. If like you are dependent on the land, even your culture ties you there. In some cases, the interventions have been done by farmers over a long period of time. Climate change did not start yesterday, just like most people say that climate has been changing. Yes, it has been changing and people have been adapting for a long period of time. If you look at the ecosystem here in central Uganda, around the shores of Lake Victoria in Buganda, Busoga mainly, people used to practice an agroforestry form of system where they intercrop trees with bananas and other crops. And this used to be a stable ecosystem that would absorb most of these changes which we are talking about. But because of certain reasons, settlement, all those pressures coming up, demographics, we are turning against the trees and cutting them down to be able to get quick money from charcoal burning and the rest of that. And part of the areas where like changes are happening, just like Ole said, referred to the mountains, you find that coffee, which used to do well in the low-lying areas of Mount Rwenzori, around the Kasese areas, it no longer does well. It is shifting up towards the top of the mountains. And the few farmers that can be able to grow Arabica coffee are those ones who can provide shade by planting agroforestry species. I've visited a number of farmers, and this is quite impressive, where they do that. They intercrop trees with the coffee. Yes, and even matoke. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you get food in there, you get a cash crop. And they also do furrows. They kind of do trenches which trap soil and water, so that when it is raining and water runs from up the mountains, it enters the soil and it is held there for a long period of time. And even when they have harsh weather conditions in the dry weather, they are able to have this coffee thriving. So there are those interventions which are doing great and doesn't really cost so much for these farmers to be able to do the same thing. And in any case, in some communities, it is something which is inherent. It's not something which came up yesterday. They have been doing it for a long period of time. It's just simply they are being reminded to do it better.
Ole said something about when he was speaking about Arabica coffee and how we might get to a point where they're not able to plant it in those areas. What do we do to not get to that point?
I think this is a big risk which we are faced with and which the farmers are grappling with on the mountains. And you see there are fights which have been taking place between farmers on Mount Rwenzori and even Elgon. And both of these mountains, they have got reserves which have been established on the top because of ecological sensitivity. Some of these support ecosystems that you will not find anywhere else in the world. And because of the changes of climate change, farmers, some of them have been coping by moving up further up on the mountains. And this has set up a conflict between the institutions which manage the reserves, and this is Uganda Wildlife Authority, and the communities that are coming in. So it's not quite easy that they can easily adapt. Some farmers have been doing that. But other farmers, they are taking up some of these practices where they can intercrop their trees, provide to be able to get shade. They can be able to get more moisture getting down there into the soil. they can be able to get organic matter, because some of these trees drop very rich litter, which is able to fertilize their crops, and they are able to grow coffee for some period of time. But going forward, I think a lot of changes need to happen, because we are talking about a cash crop being replaced, fortunately not in the near future. It could be about 20 or 30 years. And that means we must shift probably from one crop to another, where farmers can be supported to be able to generate income and also to preserve the mountains, because climate change is not going to stop now.
Is that the only answer, Ole?
I think it's great to talk about some solutions. I mean, that's what we should do. And I think maybe I can give a few suggestions to the. Now we talked about coffee, so why don't we just keep with coffee? So really, what Gerald was mentioning, there are two fundamental issues or two fundamental solutions just in front of us, right? One is to replace the coffee trees, and the other one is to provide shade trees into agroforestry. And even though, Gerald, you're saying that these solutions are fairly cheap, we still see that farmers are not necessarily adopting them. I think you are extremely, you're very right in your point that these are not new solutions, and you know, they are definitely not Danish solutions, right? They are local Ugandan solutions that already exist. We just need a tiny push and kind of a little bit of support, then people will take it up. And I'll give two examples how we can do that, and how Denmark has also worked together with Ugandan partners on that. So in Western Uganda, there are some very well-functioning coffee cooperatives. And there's one called ACPCU just east of Mbarara.
ACPCU.
Sorry. That abbreviation will be the only abbreviation that survives in this podcast. Ankole Cooperative Production Coffee Union. No. That's definitely not it, but
I will Google it for
you. You can Google it for me. It's a guy called John. He doesn't have an abbreviation.
Ankole Coffee Producers Cooperative Union. You are
Thank
right.
you. Yeah. Ankole Coffee Producers Cooperative Union basically does two things. They take the coffee, they buy the coffee from 13,000 farmers and export it directly to Europe. That's one thing they do. And then they support these farmers. And what do they support these farmers with? Well, they support them to adopt agroforestry systems, and they provide seedlings for shade trees. And I think, you know, the solutions are easy to think of. What is difficult is to how to get it to scale, like how to really get this to everybody.
I think that is right on spot. And you find that in many cases, information is not reliable because of challenges within the institutions that are supposed to pick this information. For instance, the weather organization, it is still being capacitated, and they will tell you that they have like 30-40% of the staff which they should have. And even the deployment of the weather machines, which are supposed to pick information and localize the weather reports, they don't have enough. So they'll say, it's going to rain in these 2 weeks, and there's no rain. And simply because they have not collected information that can be able to give actual information to a specific place. So farmers in that given area will say, no, this is just simply hot air. So whereas from a regional perspective, they'll be able to get it right. But in terms of specific information to some of these farmers, they'll not be able to get it. And I think that is a very big challenge. And in this country, I don't think we are moving the right way.
You've spoken like a true journalist, trying to push the agenda of information sharing and not having it left out. Maybe in closing, from both of you, and I'll start with you, Ole. If we continue business as usual, what does the future look like for us? I'm not just speaking to agriculture, but climate change as a whole. What does the future look like?
Well, if we do nothing, it will simply be very expensive. But if we act now, it's not there's simple things we can do. And I think we have talked a lot about smallholder farmers. It's definitely true for smallholder farmers. We should focus even more on those groups that are the most vulnerable. But it's actually also true if you zoom out a little bit in larger perspectives. So something like infrastructure, for example, you know, Uganda, fortunately, is growing very fast and is building a lot of infrastructure, which is great. And actually, it's not it's not a lot more expensive to build a bridge that is ready for the rainfall we shall see in 10 or 20 years than to build it adapted to the rainfall that is there now. It's not much more expensive, but it does require you to, as Gerald was saying, look at the data. You need the data, you need the projections, and then you need to plan for it and to really use that data. And I think, you know, for Denmark, it's the same. It's actually not it's not automatic that we take in, that we go and find that information, and then we actually adjust our plans so they fit what we know that the future will bring.
So what you're asking us is to think climate change in every sector. Because
exactly.
I know there's a lot of focus on climate change and agriculture, and if you're talking about roads and bridges that will survive 20 years from now, that's a lot of having people sit down and intentionally think, what's 20 years going to be like for us? And I'm not sure how much of that we're doing.
No, I think I couldn't have said it more precise. It's exactly not a sector. The people working with the people not working with climate change, they have to start paying attention to it. And the people already working with climate change, they need to translate what they know to everybody else. Because it is something that comes before the sector, if you will. Are you doing infrastructure? You know, you need to think of it before you start building. I met one of the big chicken companies raising broilers and day old chicks, and they told me we have to change the way that we build our chicken houses because we can see that we get more hot days. So we need all of a sudden we need ventilation and we need. And imagine if you're making that type of investment without thinking about how will the temperature look in 10 years, you know, then you have to rebuild in 5 years. So, if we go on as usual, it's much more expensive. If we do something now, yeah.
That's a really good example of these chicken houses. I think the way we like our chicken, nothing brings it home like that. Gerald, if we continue business as usual, what does the future look like for us?
Very risky future. And I don't think we should have that as a choice. We have to do something, and we need to do big things. I've seen many people who are doing adaptation measures or even a mitigation. They are not jumping off the ground the way we should be jumping. When you go to international meetings like the Conference of Parties, you see people sharing testimonies. Some are worse off than the Bududas of this world, which I've been talking about in this platform. You see climate change happening in a real way. But also here, we've had it, Bududa, Kasese. Business as usual cannot be our choice. At a global level again, we see climate action as one of the Sustainable Development Goals, SDG 13. And it's talking about a range of actions, trying to wake up the world that we are facing a crisis. We need to do something. We have all those goals. We've tried to domesticate or localize that with the climate change policy, the climate change law. These should not just simply be mere papers. They should be translated into real actions for individuals, actions for the community, where you work, as government, we need to do something. Many times when like it rains, like today, this afternoon, as an individual, I was thinking about where do I pass?
Flooding.
Yes, to get home. There are spots which I know definitely are going to flood. Clock Tower, then the other side, Banda, Chireka, that area. I stay in Weogere. So I'll not pass anywhere near there. I'll take an alternative route. That is one example. But just like Ole has been saying, we need to integrate climate change in many of our development perspectives. You find a road, it has been constructed like that for the past 30, 20 years. And even today as we speak, they are constructing an underpass around between Chireka and Weogere. And it's almost the same. It's the one which it is replacing. There's no change. We need to take hydrology very seriously. We need to take care of the bad waste management practices which we have. When it rains, in most communities, that is when people are waiting to throw rubbish so that water can take it away. Take it where? it ends up blocking some of these areas, the culverts, getting trapped in some of the wetlands, and water cannot go. What happens? There's a backflow, and people are losing a livelihood, they are losing a life. So many things. We need to change, we need to be each brother's keeper, we need to be there for each other. That money which should be for development, we must not steal it. We need to develop proper accountability systems, we need to be responsible. Many things, we've had them, the chiteses of this world. People don't want to take care of waste. Out of sight, out of my backyard, there's no problem. But there's a bigger problem we are creating at Chiteze. And not only that, when I decide to work in my community, all the time I'm jumping banana peelings, pampas, and stuff like that. That has far-reaching implications, not only to the hydrology of how the water is going to flow, but also our health. Some people opt to burn waste. We are inheriting all this waste. We cannot afford to live the same way. We need to wake up. Some people will keep on saying, government etuyambe, that is a sign of powerlessness. We have a lot of power in our hands. What if we came together as a community and decided to plant trees? What if we came together and decided that we must sort waste at home in this community and probably add more value, and it creates employment for a few people within our community. It would solve the problem and also create unemployment. There are many, many opportunities around most of these things, and we can't afford to sit back.
Gerald, I'm thinking very heavily about that award you won for your climate change reporting, and I'm seeing why you won that award. Just listening to you speak to that.
Thank you.
Thank you both so much for making the time. And so there are challenges, as we've had listening to both of you, Ole and Gerald, speaking. So we see a risky and an expensive future if we continue business as usual. But also listening to both of you, there are solutions, and the solutions are within. It's really, I think, more about us being more intentional. You spoke about the laws and the policies that are there. But you also spoke about information being a challenge, and we will get into that, I'm hoping, in subsequent episodes of this podcast. So thank you for listening in today. In the episodes that will follow, I'll be delving a little deeper into the science, the stories, and the solutions associated with climate change. But not just as the host of the podcast, as a traveler, finding my way around what we have often called a complex discussion. This is not just a podcast, it's a shared journey. My name is Josephine Karenji. See you next time. And if you want to reach us, climatetalkpod@gmail.com is where to write to us.